Thanks so much for listening. Before I get into the episode, I wanted to thank today's podcast sponsor, which is Coda Luna and their baby keepsake castle. I personally just put all of my baby's memorabilia into these little keepsake castle boxes, and they are so adorable, functional, and if you really love organization, then you're really going to love this keepsake box. So not only is it a keepsake box, but it also includes a baby book, and it has space for capturing all of the milestones of your baby's early years. And then the keepsake box itself stores all of the memorabilia that you want to keep. So baby's first socks and pacifier and the little hat that they wore when they came home from the hospital. So this keepsake castle with the baby memory book is more than just an organizational product. It's a gateway to preserving the remarkable journey of new parenthood. So take a moment to visit keepsakecastle.com today and embark on creating a lasting legacy of love and nostalgia.
Thank you so much for listening. In today's show, we're going to be talking about teaching toddlers emotional intelligence. Our guest, Alyssa Blask, is an emotional development expert with a master's degree in early education. She's also the founder and CEO of Seed and Sow, an organization committed to giving parents, teachers, and caregivers the tools to raise emotionally intelligent humans. I hope you learn a ton from the episode, and thanks again for listening. Hi, Alyssa. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing well, Amanda. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Totally. I'm jazzed to get to hang with you.
Yeah. So today we're going to be talking about emotional intelligence, teaching it to kids, how early this starts. But before we get into the details about that, I would love for listeners to have a chance to hear a little bit about you and your background.
Totally. So my master's is in early childhood. I have worked in a number of facets within early ed, a number of different roles there, and did some research in early childhood. And a colleague and I co-created the Collaborative Emotion Processing Method, CEP method, C-E-P. And we researched it across the U.S., researched it with kids birth to five, and researched it with early childhood educators and families. And we were diving into both how to build emotional intelligence in early ed and also the adult experience of kids' emotions and how we experience them, what happens in our nervous system. And then when you're using the CEP method, how does that shift? What else is going on? And it was pretty rad because at the end of our research, one of my favorite parts of the data that I would say for me was unexpected was that teachers and parents were reporting less burnout, less overwhelm, less exhaustion at the end of the day when they were utilizing the CEP method. And that had been my personal experience as we developed it. And it just became a part of how I show up in the world in relationship with humans. But it was really cool to see that show up with teachers and parents outside of just me. And yeah. And so then my work has been based around that. I run an organization called Seed and Sow, and we have courses for parents. We have an Instagram podcast, all that jazz. And then we have a professional development program and community for early childhood educators, folks in childcare that are doing this work.
Wow. That's fantastic. Will you go into a little more detail about the CEP method?
Totally. So it's five components. And we joke that folks come to us for the tiny humans and they stay for themselves. So they come and they're like, okay, these big emotions, or I have a colicky baby, or my one-year-old's throwing their food on the ground and staring me in the face while they do it, or my three-year-old's pushing a sibling, etc. And then as we dive into it, folks realize like, oh, this is about us. Like our toolbox really matters here. And so what we aim to do is give parents, teachers, caregivers, the fishing pole, right? Instead of just handing them the fish, like teaching them how to fish. And the CEP method has five components. One is adult-child interaction. So one is like, what do we do in the moment? How are we showing up with the kids? How are we helping them build these tools? And not just for like, quote, taming tantrums, but really for emotion processing. How are we giving them tools for coping and creating a space where they are safe to process hard experiences. And then the other four components are about us. So we have self-awareness, what's happening for us, noticing what's happening in our bodies, scientific knowledge, the acknowledgement of mirror neurons and the neuroscience behind all this, what's happening in, when a baby laughs and you have that, like, you fill with that oxytocin, they're like, it's the best sound, right? And the other night, my son, he's 14 months, got the giggles like in the bathtub, and it was just infectious. And acknowledging that the same thing happens when they're screaming, that inside your nervous system is firing too, right? Like, we all know that feeling when the baby starts to cry, and immediately you're like, your body wants to make it stop because it wants to make it stop within you. And so that's part two, is that scientific knowledge, the neuroscience component, bias. And here we're looking at uncovering implicit biases. So we're diving into, what did it look like for you growing up? What were you taught? How were you responded to? Were there certain emotions that were allowed, certain that weren't? Was it based on gender in your household? Is that coming up for you at all? Are there certain ages or stages that maybe as a kid you were expected to stop crying, and now that's coming up in parenthood for you? Really looking at those biases that we all have. It's not a dirty word. If you have a brain, you have bias. And really getting to know them, those parts of ourselves, with compassion, with non-judgment, with the understanding that all of our parents were doing the best they could with the tools they had, just like we are. And it's not about perfection. We just want to get to know those parts so that we can be aware of, I say, when I open my mouth, my mom comes out. And sometimes that's great, right? Sometimes I'm like, cool, I'd like to repeat that. And sometimes I'm like, I'd like to do that one differently. And we can't make those changes until we're aware of it. And then the last adult component is self-care. And this is so buzzwordy, right? Like, and sometimes I get annoyed by it because I'm like, great, I don't have time for a massage or a 30-minute bath or whatever. And so for us, it's really looking at, what does it look like to take care of our nervous system throughout the day in practical ways when you are parenting, or when you are an early childhood educator, when you're working with kids and you don't have someone to tap out to, or you don't have a spare 20 minutes or even 10, like, what does it look like to take care of your nervous system so that you can show up with intention? Yeah. So that's a SEP method.
Thank you for explaining that. And I agree with you about the self-care. I get a little annoyed by the buzzword of it. And the connotation that most people attribute to it, of like, it is a bubble bath or it is getting a massage. And, it's usually more boring stuff that you don't really want to do, but you do it in the short term so that in the long term, you are truly taking care of yourself. It is cooking, it's doing the laundry, it's, going to bed early, stopping the scroll, and getting enough sleep. I mean, to me, that's what it is. So I'm glad that you brought that up, because that's something that I talk about all the time on the podcast, at home, with my husband, with friends, like, big one for me.
Totally.
So I'm also curious to hear your take on this. And I kind of just want to like ground us in what is emotional intelligence?
Yeah, there are four components to emotional intelligence. Also another buzzwordy thing right now, social emotional development, et cetera. So emotional intelligence has four components: self-awareness, self-regulation, social awareness, and empathy. So often we have folks coming to us for the self-reg, empathy, and social awareness. We want kids who have the tools to calm their bodies, to connect with folks around them, to kind of like read the room, if you will, and to know like, oh, this is how I behave when I'm at home. This is how I behave in a restaurant, right? That social awareness component. And then empathy, to be able to empathize with those around them, to feel things like remorse, etc. And the bummer of it all is like, you can't do those three without self-awareness. If you aren't aware of your body, of what's happening in your body, you can't show up and empathize with someone else. You're not going to be in the space to take in the room, to read the room. You're definitely not going to be able to regulate your nervous system.
Yeah, I think that is so important and foundational as well. of just being able to, without judgment, and you had mentioned this before when you were talking about the SEP method, but without judgment, just be aware of like, I am pissed right now that like my baby has been screaming for 10 minutes, and not judge yourself and not be like, I'm this type of parent, or I shouldn't be, like, just like noting, like, I'm pissed.
Yeah.
Or I'm pissed to stop.
You know, for me, when I entered into parenthood, I didn't have one of those babies who would just like sleep anywhere. And I have a sister-in-law that I'm very close with, and their youngest and my oldest are 3 weeks apart. And we have very different babies. And their babe was a human that they'd be like, oh yeah, we're going to like a restaurant, we're going shopping. And he's just like snoozing in the car seat. And I'm like, well, mine's screaming. and that awareness of like, it's okay for me to feel disappointed about this, that like, this is harder. And then teaching the kids how to build awareness of their bodies. And ultimately, that we can't expect them to regulate their bodies until they have that awareness. And that's always where we're starting. It is the foundation of all of it. And I think of it like reading to kids, where we're reading to babies and we're not like, cool, now read back to me. We're reading to babies for them to read back to us in years.
Right.
Right. And like, exactly. That is so much of this work. Like, we don't get to, in fact, it was really interesting in the research, what we found was really low expectations of infants and toddlers, and then high expectations of 3 and 4 and 5 year olds, right? So like, it was that we don't expect a baby to be able to calm themselves, right? Like, we do jump up and soothe, et cetera. And 1 year olds, we expect that they don't have the language yet, right? We don't, a lot of folks will say to me, like, do they even understand this? And there's just a low expectation of what we are expecting from them to be able to show up and do with other humans, with themselves, et cetera. And so what we found was that we weren't, quote, reading to the kids at this point, right? Like, almost tabling it, expecting that they're going to get to a certain age and then they'll have these skills. Then they'll be able to calm. Then they'll be able to understand what I'm saying so that they can calm their bodies. And the reality is that we're building this from the jump. We're building it right away. We're reading to them when they're infants, when we are talking about what we're doing, when they are crying, we're starting to lay those foundations of saying, oh my goodness, you're so disappointed. You're trying so hard to go forward and your body keeps scooting backwards. When we have those early crawlers, right? And they're trying to get to something. I could very easily just slide that toy closer to them that they're trying to get to and solve the problem and miss this opportunity to let them feel disappointment and to emotion coach them and let them start to build a comfort with, oh yeah, what does it feel like to be in this? And I don't have to rush this feeling away, and I can start to acknowledge it and build awareness of it. That awareness component starts way younger than we often give kids credit for.
So that is a great segue into really answering the question that we're posing with the topic for this episode, which is, how early can you start teaching emotional intelligence?
Yeah, once you got a baby. Kickstart. In fact, before.
When you're pregnant?
Yeah.
When you're expecting?
If you're a human carrying a child, or you know you're going to have a baby in your house, working on your own awareness and regulation is always where we're going to start, because you will not, I guarantee you, I'd put money on it, will not be able to show up and do this work with them if you don't do it with yourself first. We can't teach what we don't know. We can't teach what we're not modeling. You can tell a kid all day long, here's what I want you to do, or here's what to do when you're feeling frustrated. I had a little girl in preschool who was, you know, she was the kid I could like send to do anything, and she would do it. She wasn't going to like, it wasn't going to be like, eh, it's been quiet for too long or whatever. She was going to do it and come back, and I could trust that that was going to happen. And her dad dropped her off one morning and was like, last night she said the F word. Any ideas on where she heard that? And she's like not a kid that I could even picture the word coming out of her mouth. And I was like, I mean, it's not a word that we drop at school a lot, but we can ask her. And so I called her over and I asked her, I was like, hey babe, last night I heard that you said the F word to your brother. Where did you hear it? And she was like, oh, when daddy drives. And he was like, yep. Okay. Yep. He was like, all right, have a good day. And the reality is like, that's fine. It's going to happen. These things are, yeah, it's going to happen. We aren't perfect humans. And it was just like this perfect example of our modeling goes so much farther than what we say. And so if we want to start teaching this, we got to start practicing it. We've got to start with building our own awareness of like, what does it feel like when you feel that rush of cortisol or adrenaline? Where do you feel it in your body? Usually I get a little sweaty, my chest gets tight, my heart starts to race, my hands might clench. And when I start to notice those things, that is now my cue to like, all right, take a breather here, Alyssa, pump the brakes. If a kid isn't running into the street, they're not in real danger, then this is perceived danger. And in actuality, like my baby's hungry. And if I can take 10 seconds and take some deep breaths and calm myself, I can model for them that they are safe, that I'm coming and that they are safe. But if I rush over with all my cortisol and all my adrenaline pumping through my veins, my body is sending the message to them that they are not safe. Right? Like that's that mirror neuron component of the SEP method. And so when can you start? Now. Wherever you are right now is the perfect time. It's never too early and it's never too late. I started this work before I had kids, and also you can start it when they're 16. I mean, my mom just a couple months ago reached out and she was like, I've been learning so much. And she's not a human who like, I was shocked. I was like, oh, I didn't see that coming. She's like, I started listening to the podcast. Mind you, the podcast, our podcast has been up and running for 4 years. But she was like, I started listening to the podcast and I'm learning so much. And it's never too late. Like, yeah, it's always going to be helpful. If you imagine yourself as an adult, if all of a sudden your parent came up and was like, hey, I learned some of these new things, and I realized that when you were a teenager and you were coming to me with X, Y, and Z, like I responded like this, I'm sorry, I dropped the ball. Like, that would still hit home and feel good inside. It's never too late. So you could have a child of any age and now's the perfect time to start.
I love that. And, thinking about where we started this conversation, and your research and, diving into like the neuroscience behind it. One of my big aha moments was when my oldest was a toddler, about your child's age, and I started reading The Happiest Toddler on the Block and was learning about the upstairs brain and the downstairs brain and, what happens to a toddler's brain when they are either having a tantrum or just like upset. And that their upstairs brain, their prefrontal cortex, it goes offline. It is not in charge. It's not running the show. Their reptilian brain, their survival brain kicks in. And then I kept learning about stuff like that. And not just for toddlers, but for all humans. And realized like, oh crap, it's the same. When I get upset, when my husband and I are in a disagreement or a fight, my prefrontal cortex is offline. I am experiencing perceived danger, a perceived threat, and my reptile brain is running the show. And it's like, get to safety, be okay, survive. And so for me, that's been a game changer to realize we're not so different, you and me, with my 3-year-old.
Totally.
When we are emotionally upset, and it actually is like a really helpful connection point for that empathy as well, mm-hmm. of like, dang, this is hard when you're really mad or upset or scared. It is hard to like get back down to homeostasis. And it's the same thing going through their tiny little bodies in their tiny little brains.
Yeah. And so often we expect them to do something that we aren't doing, right? Like when we think of the amygdala is what you're describing, and like the primal brain, that is the like the fight, flight, freeze, fawn part. And you're right, the prefrontal cortex shuts down, the amygdala fires, which is awesome, because like if a kid is running into the street, I don't want you in your prefrontal cortex. I don't want you saying, should I go pick them up? Like, no, I want you to react and go scoop them up, right? But we think of it like a fire alarm where it goes off no matter what. It's not like, oh, is it a real fire? Or is it my humidifier that's too close to my alarm? Or did somebody blow out a birthday candle and now there's smoke in the air? Like, it just goes off. And that's what your amygdala does. It just goes off. And then it's our job to assess, like, is this perceived threat or is it a real threat? And if it's real threat, you will just react and you should. You know, we were in line at a restaurant the other day, and I was putting our name in, and my husband had our kiddo in his arms, like a few people back from me. And all of a sudden I heard that cry where like, I just like immediately turned. He had touched a thing and burnt his finger, like immediate blister on his finger. It's such a different sound that, but I've had to decipher that. Like, it's been a lot of training of my body where like immediately when you become a parent, any cry, you're like, what is it? And you like rush to your amygdala's on, and it takes a little time to decipher like, oh, that cry means they're getting tired, or this cry means like they're frustrated that they're in the car seat. And then this one means I'm hurt, like I need something. And you do start to learn to decipher those when you can calm your nervous system to tune in. And that's the hard part.
It is.
The calming to tuning in is a doozy.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that's why it makes so much sense that your method is so focused on the adult, like a tiny little component actually involving the kids, because it takes a lot of work. You also mentioned a phrase that I'm curious about. Can you talk about emotion coaching?
Yeah, totally. I've recently been told that like sometimes I get too nerdy. So anytime you please call me out on any language you'd like me to dive into.
Sure.
Yes, emotion coaching is really how we are responding in the moment. So we have two options in the moment. We can react based off of our social programming and our habits and that rush of cortisol and adrenaline, or we can take ownership over our regulation and we can respond with intention. The goal isn't perfection. You're not going to respond with intention all the time, and that's okay. I've never left a day with kids and been like, I was perfect today. It's not the goal. They're going to drop the ball. They're going to make mistakes. So as I'm going through this, I want to first preface with like, give yourself grace. And if you're not responding with intention, if you're not emotion coaching all the time, that's okay. You're doing fine. The kids will be fine. Like this is all right. So emotion coaching is when we are responding with intention. We have five phases of emotion processing that all of us, whether you're 9 months old or 90 years old, go through to process an emotion. And the first four are about helping the nervous system feel safe and seen so that it can start to regulate, and then we can enter into emotion processing. We separate these into two different things. We call it, I have what I call the triangle of growth, and the base of it is your sensory systems. That's your nervous system. And this is what we're trying to say, like, hey, brain, it's okay to shut down that amygdala and turn back on that prefrontal cortex. You're not in danger, and I gotcha. And in order to do that, kids need to feel, all of us need to feel safe and seen. And then we can enter into emotion processing. So we have allowing as the first phase. Sounds super simple, super hard to do. Allowing them to feel, which means we're not problem solving. I'm not talking them through while they're crying and whining, et cetera, screaming. I'm not going like, oh, you really wanted this cup. Like, I wonder if we go over here, maybe we can wash it and then we can get it. Or you really wanted to touch the bear at the zoo and we can't reach inside the cage to touch it. Like, oh man, I wonder if when we get home, we can get your stuffed animal. That's problem solving. They're not ready. Allowing is simply letting them feel with boundaries. I won't let you hurt my body. And within each cultural context and within each home, there will be different ground rules for allowing. For us in my household, it's that we operate with respect. And for us, that means physically, that I won't let you hurt my body, I won't let you hurt your body, and I won't let you hurt our things. Like, you can't throw a mug on the floor. It doesn't mean what I grew up with as respect, which is a respectful tone. Like, if you're mad, it makes sense that you're not speaking to me with, quote, kindness, right? Like, it's really hard for me as an adult to access that in the moment, too. For us, it's physical safety there. And then no name calling is another rule in our house, not to anyone else or to yourself. So that includes like, oh, I'm so stupid, not allowed. And you made a stupid choice. Is how we'll shift that from shame to guilt. So those are our two family rules. And that goes for adults as well. We'll call each other out on it as well as adults. And I will hold hands and say, oh, I won't let you hurt my body. And now I'm going to move into phase two, which is recognizing their perceived feeling. It's okay if you get it wrong. Like as they start to build an emotional library and they learn these different words, they'll correct you. In the same way that if down the road you pointed to their leg and you said, oh, there's your arm, they would say, no, here's my arm. And they would point to it. The same thing will happen with emotions as they start to learn those words. If they never heard the word leg or heard the word arm, they wouldn't be able to correct you on those things. And so we're going to offer up like, oh man, you look so frustrated. You look so mad or you look so sad in this. And I'm going to connect with them. The words that you say are not as important as the connection. So what I want them to know is I see you. I get it. I'm not saying I condone the behavior. I'm not saying I would feel the same way if I got an orange cup instead of a purple cup. It doesn't matter if you agree with why they're feeling. We're connecting over what they're feeling. So, oh man, you were working so hard to build that tower and your sister just came in and knocked it down. Gosh, that's frustrating. I'm not saying, so it makes sense that you hit her. Like that isn't, that's not a part of this. I'm just saying, I get it. That like, I know that if I had folded all the laundry and that tiny human came in and destroyed all those piles, I would feel frustrated. And can I fold it again? Sure. Do I want to? No. Like it makes sense to feel frustrated in this moment. I understand that feeling. And that's what we're connecting over. And so I'm going to validate that. And then we're going to move into security, where I'm going to let them know, like, oh, how can I help your body feel calm or feel safe are the two words. And that triggers to the brain, like, oh, another feeling exists, which means I won't feel this way forever. It allows us to be in an emotion knowing that you won't be in it forever. When we don't have security, we're seeing things like anxiety. This is where we get stuck in a feeling because we're trying to get out of it. We're trying to make it go away. When a kid feels scared and we keep trying to problem solve out of it, we're saying it's not safe to feel scared. And instead, I want them to know it makes sense to feel scared. Yeah, that makes total sense. It's scary when you're by yourself in the car seat and you're facing the other way and you can't see me anymore. That might feel scary. You might feel lonely. You're not sure where I went. I get that. We're triggering to the brain like other emotions exist. So these first three are allowing them to feel safe and seen. And now we move into coping. There are two different types of coping, coping mechanisms and coping strategies. Coping mechanisms are like temporary relief. It's usually dopamine related, which is the reward center of our brain. Not a bad hormone, but you're going to want more and more and more. And it doesn't actually calm the nervous system to be able to access problem solving. So sometimes we'll use them. Like you're getting out the door to something, or if you have a child who's neurodiverse, you might need to use a coping mechanism in order to access a coping strategy. A coping mechanism could be distraction, playfulness. It can look like we're distracting them out of their feelings. We're really just getting like a hit of dopamine in their body. And then it's going to like have temporary numbing. It can be screens as they get older, a pacifier, a lovey, sometimes food. My little guy's like favorite coping mechanism is nursing, where like he's not even hungry at that time, but he's like, oh, I'm in a situation where I feel overwhelmed or something like that. And he'll come over and ask to nurse. And sometimes we'll nurse for like a minute or two. And then when he pulls off, then we'll tap into a coping strategy. These are things that really regulate the body. So it's a few different types of sensory input. Sometimes it's moving the plane of your head, like doing dips or spinning. Some babies want to bounce. Proprioceptive input is the other one. This is that big body play. So this could be doing 10 big jumps, or with a baby, it might be a tight swaddle that then goes hand in hand with a bounce for some of them. It could be being worn or just feeling that closeness with somebody else. As kids get older, it might be jumping into a pillow pile, or you know what, we're going to run, we're going to do a little race, or how many frog jumps do you think it'll take us to get from here to there? So all this is happening to now help calm the nervous system. And then once we're calm, then we're navigating problem solving, conflict resolution, emotion processing, etc. Like once we're calm, then I'm like, oh man, you really didn't want to get into your car seat. I saw you arching your back and you were so mad. I get that. You were having so much fun playing, and it's not fun to stop playing to get in your car seat. next time when we're going to get into your car seat, do you want to do some big jumps on the way over there? Or, you know what, next time we can do some dips. With this is a huge one with the little baby that's struggling to get in. I'll do some dips. Or if they're vestibular sensitive, if they don't like the movement of their head, like they don't like that swinging and rocking, then I will wear them like 5 or 10 minutes before we're going to the car to get some of that proprioceptive input, that big deep pressure input. When kids don't like the car seat, a lot of the time, especially as babies, you're getting vestibular input. So it's going to move the plane of their head. It messes with like where you are in space. They're rear facing and they're going the other way. So automatically there's that. And then there's a jiggle and a shake in there that's built in. And, you know, enough, hopefully though we're safe, but like there's going to be a little jiggle shake. And so if a kid's sensitive to that, yeah, I'll get some input in like that deep pressure before we get in. And then my little guy was vestibular sensitive as well. We put like we worked with an OT to find the right size, but like a weighted pad. It was so light, but enough for him that was like a blanket that just gave him a little extra pressure. As a teeny newborn, I just like once he was buckled, swaddled him in with a blanket. So his arms were down and he was snug. And then as he got older, we used a little weighted pad. And those have been really helpful. For that sensitivity for anyone else who might be living that with a screaming newborn.
Yes.
And then the problem solving. The biggest gap that we see is the jump to problem solving too soon.
Yes.
Because we wanted to go away.
Right. Yeah. And I would also echo, you know, where we started with this, that the jump to problem solving, I could see that being a big one that a lot of people do. And then also just the struggle with your own emotional regulation, because you have to start with that. You can't do any of the strategies or coping mechanisms with them. Do you do it for yourself?
1,000%. Yeah. And that's why we jump to problem solving, because we're not doing it for ourselves. We're like, I want this feeling inside me to go away.
Exactly.
And so I need this thing inside of you to stop.
It is. It's a big undertaking. I mean, it's like something I don't know if I would use the word struggle with. Every day, like I bump up against it every day. That's how I'll say it. I used to struggle with it every day, and I've gotten a little bit better, and I've built my own toolbox, and I've then also learned about it along the way with my kids, and I've gotten more practice in. But I still bump up against it every day. It is
totally
just like
same.
That is the work of parents. Like, that's it.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that, you know, we talked about the time frame of like, it's never too early to start and it's never too late to start, because it's the work of parents.
It's ongoing. That's the most annoying part. Our team at Seed, every once in a while, someone will just pop in and be like, I'm so annoyed that I have to do the work again today. Like every day we have to do it. And like, how annoying to have to, like, I would love to just take a day off sometimes. And sometimes we do. Sometimes we're going to tap into coping mechanisms. The other night I was presenting at nighttime, and so I wasn't here for bedtime. And generally I do bedtime. And I came in and it was a bit of a disaster. And so I tapped in and my husband tapped out and put my little guy down, and I came downstairs and he was like, I know that these are coping mechanisms, but I'm going to have some ice cream and scroll my phone. And I was like, good for you. Yeah. Just numb for a minute, just numb, and giving ourselves that grace that, like, yeah, sometimes we don't have the energy or the capacity to regulate and go through all these steps, and that's okay. It's just making sure that if we find ourselves in this repeated cycle of always tapping into coping mechanisms to numb those feelings in ourselves, that A, it's going to lead to more burnout and exhaustion. It's a cycle, because your nervous system doesn't fully calm and produce that serotonin that it needs to really regulate. We can also then see, with that serotonin not being produced, an uptick in things like anxiety and depression in parents. And ultimately, like, if we aren't doing this for ourselves, we're not gonna be able to teach it. And so recognizing that it's gonna mean, like, sometimes for me, it's boundaries is the best form of self-care. And it's usually boundaries with myself, like not even boundaries with other people necessarily, but like, yeah, when I put my little guy down for a nap, one of my personal boundaries is not scrolling for at least 5 minutes. Like, 5 minutes after he goes down, I make myself, and I never want to, make myself tap into a coping strategy. I can step outside. I can do 5 minutes of stretching. There's like a list that I have for myself of things that I can do for 5 minutes to calm my nervous system before I scroll.
I love that so much. I love everything that you just said. The boundaries with yourself, so important. Your particular example, I love that. And what I love the most and want to reiterate is the fact that you are a professional. You have a master's degree in this. You do this every single day, and you have a list for yourself. You keep a list. I am the queen of, I call it cheat sheets, lists. Make it easy. Serve it to yourself on a silver platter. Serve it to others on a silver platter. Writing it down so that you don't have to use extra energy in your brain to remember, what are my strategies or what are my coping mechanisms? What are my options? You, the expert, have it written down. So like, I just want to reiterate that for anyone listening that like, yes to cheat sheets. It doesn't say anything about your knowledge or your practice or anything about you as a person. It's just like, make it easy. Keep a note in your phone. Keep it on the fridge, nightstand. So thank you.
Yeah, totally. We call them visual aids at Seed, and I have a whole workshop on how to use them with kids because they're so important. We have it for our teachers, and it's wild because I think we don't, I'm so glad that you acknowledge that, because I think it's something that we gloss over a lot for ourselves and for kids, that it takes so much of our energy. We know this, right? The mental load where we're like, okay, they need diapers and their clothes are about to size out. And oh my gosh, summer's coming. Right. Did I order sunscreen? Right? Like all the things that run around in our head, the same thing's happening for kids, that in their head, they're like, all right, is today a home day or a school day? Is mom coming? Is it mama or mommy or dad? Like who's doing what here? Am I going to have a bath tonight or next? Or all of these things are happening in their head too. They just don't have the word mental load to throw at you, or the words mental load to throw at you. And so for us, we look at visual aids as a tool to support the nervous system. This is one of those self-care tools that we're using them proactively throughout the day, and then we're using them in the moment. Proactively might look like a calendar on the wall. My kid has the same schedule every week of like, when he's in childcare, when he's home, et cetera. And every single day we reference the calendar with a picture of his childcare provider or a picture of us so that we can say like, oh, today is a childcare day or today is a home day. And even though every week is the same, like for him, he doesn't know yet what that means. We started that one at 12 months, but like we use his emotion cards that are visuals. We did 4 hard emotions, 4 easy emotions at the beginning. So like happy, excited, calm, safe would be easy. Hard ones for him that we chose were sad, scared, disappointed, and frustrated. I wouldn't always recommend disappointed and frustrated. Those are big words, but those are like 2 very common emotions for him. And so we did those 4. We started using them at 6 months in his space. And I would reference them. Like I'm reading Chicka Chicka Boom Boom and J and K are about to cry. I pull the sad card and like, oh, J and K are feeling sad. Oh man, I would like to give them a snuggle. And then moving right on and keep reading. He's not at 6 months like, oh yeah, they're sad. Like there's no participation in that. I'm just referencing it and acknowledging it. And about 3 months later, and I didn't use them every day. I didn't use them in every book. I didn't use them in every scenario. But then about 3 months later, we started pulling them into the moment for him when dad left for work. And he would go, and he would point to the door and we'd say, oh yeah, dad left for work. Are you feeling sad? And I would grab the emotion card. And at that point, he'd heard about this in regulated calm times for 3 months. He had a familiarity with them. And now he can reference it. And then he right now can't say any of those words at 14 months. And he can grab all of those cards. And so wow. He can go over and say, like, grab the frustrated card and he'll bring it to me. Wow. And yeah. And like scared, same thing. Like he'll grab the scared card and bring it to me. He can't say scared yet. He's not gonna be able to say scared for a while, but this is a tool he can access in the moment. And our brains can recognize those visuals more than we can take in those words in the moment. Just like You go country to country, a stop sign looks pretty similar in most countries. It doesn't matter if there's a word on it or not, your brain recognizes that visual. And the same thing for kids, that they're going to recognize these visuals well before they are both understanding and being able to produce the words.
Yeah. Wow. That's so cool. I love that. I love this whole topic. I have really, really, really enjoyed this conversation. And so thank you. Thank you for the work that you do. And thank you for having this conversation with me. If anyone listening is like, yep, I want more. I want to hear more. Where can people find you? Where can people access your courses and anything else?
Totally. Thank you. Thank you for prioritizing this conversation and putting this out there for folks. We have a pretty active Instagram, for starters, bunch of free resources and tools. Seed.and.sew is our Instagram, and I hang out there every day. And then we do have courses. If you head to seedandsew.org, there's a parents button, and it'll take you to all of our parent resources and tools. We have our Tiny Humans, Big Emotions course. Is really, we actually offer a bundle with that in our reparenting course for us as the adults. And that's where we recommend folks start, because it'll give you tools to work on this yourselves, and then give you the foundational tools for getting to know your unique child's nervous system, because we all have unique ones. And and then building those, the foundations for emotion processing.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And I'm going to link to all of that in the show notes of this episode.
Thanks, Amanda.
And thank you again.
Thank you so much for listening to the show today. If you liked the episode and would like to hear more, please follow Finding Your Village wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to use the code FYVPODCAST to sign up for the postpartum class at pregnancytopreschool.net to save 15% today. Thank you so much, and stay safe, healthy, and connected.